Divorce proceedings delayed my voyage, and the gloom of yet another world war had settled upon the globe when, after a winter of ennui and pneumonia in Portugal, I at last reached the States. In New York, I eagerly accepted the soft job fate offered me. It consisted mainly of thinking up and editing perfume ads. I welcomed its desultory character and pseudo-literary aspects, attending to it whenever I had nothing better to do. On the other hand, I was urged by a wartime university in New York to complete my comparative history of French literature for English-speaking students. The first volume took me a couple of years, during which I put in seldom less than 15 hours of work daily. As I look back on those days, I see them divided tidily into ample light and narrow shade. The light pertaining to the solace of research in palatial libraries, the shade to my excruciating desires and insomnias, of which enough has been said. Knowing me by now, the reader may well imagine how dusty and hot I got, trying to catch a glimpse of nymphettes, alas, always remote, playing in Central Park, and how repulsed I was by the glitter of deodorized career girls that a gay dog in one of the offices kept unloading upon me. Let us skip all that. A dreadful breakdown sent me to a sanatorium for more than a year. I went back to my work, only to be hospitalized again. Robust outdoor life seemed to promise me some relief. One of my favourite doctors, a charming, cynical chap with a little brown beard, had a brother, and this brother was about to lead an expedition into Arctic Canada. I was attached to it as a recorder of psychic reactions. With two young botanists and an old carpenter, I shared now and then, never very successfully, the favours of one of our nutritionists, a Dr. Anita Johnson, who was soon flown back, I'm glad to say. I had little notion of what object the expedition was pursuing. Judging by the number of meteorologists upon it, we may have been tracking to its lair, somewhere on Prince of Wales Island, I understand, the wandering and wobbly North Magnetic Pole. One group, jointly with the Canadians, established a weather station on Pierre Point in Melville Sound. Another group, equally misguided, collected plankton. A third studied tuberculosis in the tundra. Bert, a film photographer, an insecure fellow with whom at one time I was made to partake in a good deal of menial work, he too had some psychic troubles, maintained that the big men on our team, the real leaders we never saw, were mainly engaged in checking the influence of climatic amelioration on the coats of the Arctic fox. We lived in prefabricated timber cabins amid the Precambrian world of granite. We had heaps of supplies, the Reader's Digest, an ice cream mixer, chemical toilets, paper caps for Christmas. My health improved wonderfully in spite or because of all the fantastic blankness and boredom. Surrounded by such dejected vegetation as willow scrub and lichens, permeated and, I suppose, cleansed by a whistling gale, seated on a boulder under a completely translucent sky, through which, however, nothing of importance showed, I felt curiously aloof from my own self. No temptations maddened me. The plump, glossy little Eskimo girls with their fish smell, hideous raven hair and guinea pig faces evoked even less desire in me than Dr. Johnson had. Nymphettes do not occur in polar regions. I left my betters the task of analysing glacial drifts, drumlins and gremlins and kremlins, and for a time tried to jot down what I fondly thought were reactions. I noticed, for instance, that dreams under the midnight sun tended to be highly coloured, and this my friend the photographer confirmed. I was also supposed to quiz my various companions on a number of important matters, such as nostalgia, fear of unknown animals, food fantasies, nocturnal emissions, hobbies, choice of radio programmes, changes in outlook, and so forth. Everybody got so fed up with this that I soon dropped the project completely. And only toward the end of my 20 months of cold labour, as one of the botanists jocosely put it, concocted a perfectly spurious and very racy report that the reader will find published in the Annals of Adult Psychophysics for 1945 or 1946, as well as in the issue of Arctic Explorations devoted to that particular expedition. which in conclusion was not really concerned with Victoria Island copper or anything like that, as I learned later from my genial doctor, for the nature of its real purpose is what is termed hush-hush, and so let me add merely that whatever it was, that purpose was admirably achieved. The reader will regret to learn that soon after my return to civilization, I had another bout with insanity, if to melancholia and a sense of insufferable oppression that cruel term must be applied. I owe my complete restoration to a discovery I made while being treated at that particular very expensive sanatorium. I discovered there was an endless source of robust enjoyment in trifling with psychiatrists, cunningly leading them on, never letting them see that you know all the tricks of the trade, inventing for them elaborate dreams, pure classics in style, which make them, the dream extortionists, dream and wake up shrieking, teasing them with fake primal scenes, and never allowing them the slightest glimpse of one's real sexual predicament. By bribing a nurse, I won access to some files and discovered with glee cards calling me potentially homosexual and totally impotent. The sport was so excellent, its results in my case so ruddy, that I stayed on for a whole month after I was quite well, sleeping admirably and eating like a schoolgirl. And then I added another week just for the pleasure of taking on a powerful newcomer, a displaced and surely deranged celebrity, known for his knack of making patients believe they had witnessed their own conception. Upon signing out, I cast around for some place in the New England countryside, or sleepy small town, Elms, Whitechurch, where I could spend a studious summer subsisting on a compact boxful of notes I had accumulated, and bathing in some nearby lake. My work had begun to interest me again, I mean my scholarly exertions. The other thing, my active participation in my uncle's posthumous perfumes, had by then been cut down to a minimum. One of his former employees, the scion of a distinguished family, suggested I spend a few months in the residence of his impoverished cousins, a Mr. McCoo, retired, and his wife, who wanted to let their upper story where a late aunt had delicately dwelt. He said they had two little daughters, one a baby, the other a girl of 12, and a beautiful garden, not far from a beautiful lake, and I said it sounded perfectly perfect. I exchanged letters with these people, satisfying them I was housebroken, and spent a fantastic night on the train, imagining in all possible detail the enigmatic nymphette I would coach in French and fondle in Humbertish. Nobody met me at the toy station where I alighted with my new expensive bag, and nobody answered the telephone. Eventually, however, a distraught McCoo, in wet clothes, turned up at the only hotel of green and pink Ramsdale with the news that his house had just burnt down, possibly owing to the synchronous conflagration that had been raging all night in my veins. His family, he said, had fled to a farm he owned and had taken the car, but a friend of his wife's, a grand person, Mrs. Hayes of 342 Lawn Street, offered to accommodate me. A lady who lived opposite Mrs. Hayes's had lent McCoo her limousine, a marvellously old-fashioned square-topped affair manned by a cheerful negro. Now, since the only reason for my coming at all had vanished, the aforesaid arrangement seemed preposterous. All right, his house would have to be completely rebuilt, so what? Had he not insured it sufficiently? I was angry, disappointed, and bored, but being a polite European could not refuse to be sent off to Lawn Street in that funeral car, feeling that otherwise McCoo would devise an even more elaborate means of getting rid of me. I saw him scamper away, and my chauffeur shook his head with a soft chuckle. En route, I swore to myself I would not dream of staying in Ramsdale under any circumstance, but would fly that very day to the Bermudas or the Bahamas or the Blazes. Possibilities of sweetness on technicolour beaches had been trickling through my spine for some time before, and McCoo's cousin had, in fact, sharply diverted that train of thought with his well-meaning but, as it transpired now, absolutely inane suggestion. Speaking of sharp turns, we almost ran over a meddlesome suburban dog, one of those who lie in wait for cars, as we swerved into Lawn Street. A little further, the Hayes house, a white-frame horror, appeared looking dingy and old, more grey than white, the kind of place you know will have a rubber tube affixable to the tub faucet in lieu of a shower. I tipped the chauffeur and hoped he would immediately drive away so that I might double back unnoticed to my hotel and bag, but the man merely crossed to the other side of the street where an old lady was calling to him from her porch. What could I do? I pressed the bell button. A coloured maid let me in and left me standing on the mat while she rushed back to the kitchen where something was burning that ought not to burn. The front hall was graced with door chimes, a white-eyed wooden thingamabob of commercial Mexican origin, and that banal darling of the arty middle class, Van Gogh's Arlésienne. A door ajar to the right afforded a glimpse of a living room, with some more Mexican trash in a corner cabinet and a striped sofa along the wall. There was a staircase at the end of the hallway, and as I stood mopping my brow, only now did I realise how hot it had been out of doors, and staring, to stare at something, at an old grey tennis ball that lay on an oak chest, there came from the upper landing the contralto voice of Mrs. Hayes, who, leaning over the banisters, inquired melodiously, "Is that Monsieur Humbert?" A bit of cigarette ash dropped from there in addition. Presently, the lady herself, sandals, maroon slacks, yellow silk blouse, squarish face in that order, came down the steps, her index finger still tapping upon her cigarette. I think I had better describe her right away to get it over with. The poor lady was in her middle thirties. She had a shiny forehead, plucked eyebrows, and quite simple but not unattractive features of a type that may be defined as a weak solution of Marlene Dietrich. Patting her bronze-brown bun, she led me into the parlour, and we talked for a minute about the McCoo fire and the privilege of living in Ramsdale. Her very wide-set sea-green eyes had a funny way of travelling all over you, carefully avoiding your own eyes. Her smile was but a quizzical jerk of one eyebrow. And uncoiling herself from the sofa as she talked, she kept making spasmodic dashes at three ashtrays and the near fender where lay the brown core of an apple, whereupon she would sink back again, one leg folded under her. She was obviously one of those women whose polished words may reflect a book club or a bridge club or any other deadly conventionality, but never her soul. Women who are completely devoid of humour. Women utterly indifferent at heart to the dozen or so possible subjects of a parlour conversation, but very particular about the rules of such conversations, through the sunny cellophane of which not very appetizing frustrations can be readily distinguished. I was perfectly aware that if by any wild chance I became her lodger, she would methodically proceed to do in regard to me what taking a lodger probably meant to her all along, and I would again be enmeshed in one of those tedious affairs I knew so well. But there was no question of my settling there. I could not be happy in that type of household with bedraggled magazines on every chair, and a kind of horrible hybridization between the comedy of so-called functional modern furniture and the tragedy of decrepit rockers and rickety lamp tables with dead lamps. I was led upstairs, and to the left, into my room. I inspected it through the mist of my utter rejection of it. But I did discern above my bed René Prinet's Kreutzer Sonata, and she called that servant-maid's room a semi-studio. "Let's get out of here at once," I firmly said to myself, as I pretended to deliberate over the absurdly and ominously low price that my wistful hostess was asking for board and bed. Old-world politeness, however, obliged me to go on with the ordeal. We crossed the landing to the right side of the house, where I and Lo have our rooms, Lo being presumably the maid. And the lodger-lover could hardly conceal a shudder when he, a very fastidious male, was granted a preview of the only bathroom, a tiny oblong between the landing and Lowe's room, with limp, wet things overhanging the dubious tub, the question mark of a hair inside, and there were the expected coils of the rubber snake, and its complement, the pinkish cosy, coyly covering the toilet lid. "I see you're not too favourably impressed," said the lady, letting her hand rest for a moment upon my sleeve. She combined a cool forwardness, the overflow of what I think is called poise, with a shyness and sadness that caused her detached way of selecting her words to seem as unnatural as the intonation of a professor of speech. "This is not a neat household, I confess," the doomed dear continued. "But I assure you," she looked at my lips, "you will be very comfortable indeed. Let me show you the garden," the last more brightly, with a kind of winsome toss of the voice. Reluctantly, I followed her downstairs again, then through the kitchen at the end of the hall, on the right side of the house, the side where also the dining room and the parlour were, Under my room on the left, there was nothing but a garage. In the kitchen, the Negro maid, a plump youngish woman, said as she took her large glossy black purse from the knob of the door leading to the back porch, "I'll go now, Mrs. Hayes."
"Yes, Louise," answered Mrs. Hayes with a sigh. "I'll settle with you Friday."
We passed on to a small pantry and entered the dining room, parallel to the parlour we had already admired. I noticed a white sock on the floor. With a deprecatory grunt, Mrs. Hayes stooped without stopping and threw it into a closet next to the pantry. We cursorily inspected a mahogany table with a fruit vase in the middle containing nothing but the still glistening stone of one plum. I groped for the timetable I had in my pocket and surreptitiously fished it out to look as soon as possible for a train. I was still walking behind Mrs. Hayes through the dining room when beyond it there came a sudden burst of greenery.
"The piazza," sang out my leader.
And then, without the least warning, a blue sea wave swelled under my heart, and from a mat in a pool of sun, half naked, kneeling, turning about on her knees, there was my Riviera love peering at me over dark glasses. It was the same child, the same frail honey-hued shoulders, the same silky supple bare back, the same chestnut head of hair. A polka-dotted black kerchief tied around her chest hid from my aging ape eyes, but not from the gaze of young memory, the juvenile breasts I had fondled one immortal day. And as if I were the fairy-tale nurse of some little princess, lost, kidnapped, discovered in gypsy rags, through which her nakedness smiled at the king and his hounds, I recognized the tiny dark brown mole on her side. With awe and delight, the king crying for joy, the trumpets blaring, the nurse drunk, I saw again her lovely indrawn abdomen, where my southbound mouth had briefly paused, and those puerile hips on which I had kissed the crenulated imprint left by the band of her shorts, that last mad immortal day behind the Roche Rose. The 25 years I had lived since then tapered to a palpitating point and vanished. I find it most difficult to express with adequate force that flash, that shiver, that impact of passionate recognition. In the course of the sunshot moment that my glance slithered over the kneeling child, her eyes blinking over those stern, dark spectacles, the little Herr Doctor who was to cure me of all my aches, while I passed by her in my adult disguise, a great big handsome hunk of movieland manhood, the vacuum of my soul managed to suck in every detail of her bright beauty, and these I checked against the features of my dead bride. A little later, of course, she, this nouvelle, this Lolita, my Lolita, was to eclipse completely her prototype. All I want to stress is that my discovery of her was a fatal consequence of that Princeton-by-the-sea in my tortured past. Everything between the two events was but a series of gropings and blunders and false rudiments of joy. Everything they shared made one of them. I have no illusions, however. My judges will regard all of this as a piece of mummery on the part of a madman with a gross liking for the fruit vert. Au fond, ça m'est bien égal. All I know is that while the Hayes woman and I went down the steps into the breathless garden, my knees were like reflections of knees in rippling water, and my lips were like sand, and that was my lo, she said, and these are my lilies.
Yes, I said, yes, they're beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful.
Exhibit number 2 is a pocket diary bound in black imitation leather with the golden year 1947 on escalier in its upper left-hand corner. I speak of this neat product of the blank blank company Blankton, Massachusetts, as if it were really before me. Actually, it was destroyed 5 years ago, and what we examine now, by courtesy of a photographic memory, is but its brief materialization, a puny, unfledged phoenix. I remember the thing so exactly because I wrote it really twice. First, I jotted down each entry in pencil, with many erasures and corrections, on the leaves of what is commercially known as a typewriter tablet.
Then I copied it out with obvious abbreviations in my smallest, most satanic hand in the little black book just mentioned. May 30th is a fast day by proclamation in New Hampshire, but not in the Carolinas. That day an epidemic of abdominal flu, whatever that is, forced Ramsdale to close its schools for the summer. The reader may check the weather data in the Ramsdale Journal for 1947. A few days before that, I moved into the Hayes house, and the little diary which I now propose to reel off, much as a spy delivers by heart the contents of the note he swallowed, covers most of June. Thursday, very warm day. From a vantage point, bathroom window, saw Dolores taking things off a clothesline in the apple-green light behind the house. Strolled out. She wore a plaid shirt, blue jeans and sneakers. Every movement she made in the dappled sun plucked at the most secret and sensitive chord of my abject body. After a while she sat down next to me on the lower step of the back porch and began to pick up pebbles between her feet. Pebbles, my God! Then a curled bit of milk bottle glass resembling a snarling lip, and chucked them at a can. Bing! You can't a second time. You can't hit it. This is agony. A second time. Bing! Marvellous skin. Oh, marvellous. Tender and tanned. Not the least blemish. Sundays cause acne. The excess of the oily substance called sebum, which nourishes the hair follicles of the skin, creates, when too profuse, an irritation that opens the way to infection. But nymphets do not have acne, although they gorge themselves on rich food. God, what agony! That silky shimmer above her temple, grading into the bright brown hair, and the little bone twitching at the side of her dust-powdered ankle. The McCoo girl, Ginny McCoo, oh, she's a fright, and mean, and lame, nearly died of polio. Ping! The glistening tracery of down on her forearm. When she got up to take in the wash, I had a chance of adoring from afar the faded seat of her rolled-up jeans. Out of the lawn, bland Mrs. Hayes, complete with camera, grew up like a fakir's fake tree, and after some heliotropic fussing, sad eyes up, glad eyes down, had the cheek of taking my picture as I sat blinking on the steps. Humbert Lebel. Friday. Saw her going somewhere with a dark girl called Rose. Why does the way she walks, a child, mind you, a mere child, excite me so abominably? Analyze it. A faint suggestion of turned-in toes, a kind of wiggly looseness below the knee prolonged to the end of each footfall, the ghost of a drag, very infantile, infinitely meretricious. Humbert Humbert is also infinitely moved by the little one's slangy speech, by her harsh, high voice. Later heard her volley crude nonsense at Rose across the fence, twanging through me in a rising rhythm. Pause.
I must go now, kiddo.
Saturday. Beginning perhaps amended. I know it is madness to keep this journal, but it gives me a strange thrill to do so. And only a loving wife could decipher my microscopic script. Let me state with a sob that today my L was sunbathing on the so-called piazza, but her mother and some other woman were around all the time. Of course, I might have sat there in the rocker and pretended to read. Playing safe, I kept away, for I was afraid that the horrible, insane, ridiculous and pitiful tremor that palsied me might prevent me from making my entree with any semblance of casualness. Sunday. Heat ripple still with us. A most Favonian week. This time I took up a strategic position with a beast newspaper and new pipe in the piazza rocker before L arrived. To my intense disappointment, she came with her mother, both in two-piece bathing suits. Black, as new as my pipe. My darling, my sweetheart, stood for a moment near me, wanted the funnies, and she smelt almost exactly like the other one, the Riviera one, but more intensely so, with rougher overtones. A torrid odour that at once set my manhood astir. but she had already yanked out of me the coveted section and retreated to her mat near her Phocine mama. There my beauty lay down on her stomach, showing the thousand eyes wide open in my eyed blood, her slightly raised shoulder blades, and the bloom along the incurvation of her spine, and the swellings of her tense narrow nates clothed in black, and the seaside of her schoolgirl thighs. Silently the seventh grader enjoyed her green-red-blue comics. She was the loveliest nymphette green-red-blue Priap himself could think up. As I looked on, through prismatic layers of light, dry-lipped, focusing my lust and rocking slightly under my newspaper, I felt that my perception of her, if properly concentrated upon, might be sufficient to have me attain a beggar's bliss immediately. But like some predator that prefers a moving prey to a motionless one, I planned to have this pitiful attainment coincide with one of the various girlish movements she made now and then as she read, such as trying to scratch the middle of her back and revealing a stippled armpit. But Fat Hayes suddenly spoiled everything by turning to me and asking me for a light, and starting a make-believe conversation about a fake book by some popular fraud. Monday, Delectatio Morosa. I spend my doleful days in dumps and dollars. We, Mother Hayes, Dolores, and I, were to go to our glass lake this afternoon and bathe and bask. But a nacreous morn degenerated at noon into rain, and lo, made a scene. The median age of pubescence for girls has been found to be 13 years and 9 months in New York and Chicago. The age varies for individuals from 10 or earlier to 17. Virginia was not quite 14 when Harry Edgar possessed her. He gave her lessons in algebra. J'imagine cela. They spent their honeymoon at Petersburg, Florida. Monsieur Popo, as that boy in one of Monsieur Humbert Humbert's classes in Paris called the poet poet. I have all the characteristics which, according to writers on the sex interest of children, start the responses stirring in a little girl. Clean-cut jaw, muscular hand, deep sonorous voice, broad shoulder. Moreover, I am said to resemble some crooner or actor chap on whom Lo has a crush. Tuesday, rain. Lake of the rains. Mama out shopping. L, I knew, was somewhere quite near. In result of some stealthy manoeuvring, I came across her in her mother's bedroom, prying her left eye open to get rid of a speck of something. Checked frock. Although I do love that intoxicating brown fragrance of hers, I really think she should wash her hair once in a while. For a moment we were both in the same warm green bath of the mirror that reflected the top of a poplar with us in the sky. Held her roughly by the shoulders, then tenderly by the temples, and turned her about.
"It's right there," she said. "I can feel it."
Swiss peasant would use the tip of her tongue.
"Lick it out."
"Yes, shall I try?"
"Sure," she said.
Gently I pressed my quivering sting along her rolling, salty eyeball.
"Goody, goody," she said, nictating. "It is gone."
"Now the other."
"You dope," she began. "There's no—"
But here she noticed the pucker of my approaching lips.
"Okay," she said cooperatively,
and bending toward her warm, upturned, russet face, somber Humbert pressed his mouth to her fluttering eyelid. She laughed and brushed past me out of the room. My heart seemed everywhere at once. Never in my life, not even when fondling my child love in France, never. Night. Never have I experienced such agony. I would like to describe her face, her ways, and I cannot, because my own desire for her blinds me when she is near. I'm not used to being with nymphets, damn it. If I close my eyes, I see but an immobilized fraction of her. a cinematographic still, a sudden smooth nether loveliness as with one knee up under her tartan skirt she sits tying her shoe.
Dolores Hayes, ne montrez pas vos jambes.
This is her mother, who thinks she knows French. A poet, à mesure, I composed a madrigal to the soot-black lashes of her pale grey vacant eyes, to the five asymmetrical freckles of her bob nose, to the blonde down of her brown limbs. But I tore it up, and I cannot recall it today. Only in the tritest of terms, diary resumed, can I describe Lowe's features. I might say her hair is auburn, and her lips as red as licked red candy. The lower one prettily plump. Oh, that I were a lady writer who could have her pose naked in a naked light. But instead I'm lanky, big-boned, woolly-chested Humbert Humbert, with thick black eyebrows and a queer accent, and a cesspool full of rotting monsters behind his slow, boyish smile. And neither is she the fragile child of a feminine novel. What drives me insane is the twofold nature of this nymphette, of every nymphette, perhaps. This mixture in my Lolita of tender, dreamy childishness and the kind of eerie vulgarity stemming from the snub-nosed cuteness of ads and magazine pictures, from the blurry pinkness of adolescent maidservants in the old country, smelling of crushed daisies and sweat, and from very young harlots disguised as children in provincial brothels. And then again, all this gets mixed up with the exquisite stainless tenderness seeping through the musk and the mud, through the dirt and the death. Oh, God, oh, God. And what is most singular is that she, this Lolita, my Lolita, has individualized the writer's ancient lust, so that above and over everything there is Lolita. Wednesday.
Look, make Mother take you and me to Hourglass Lake tomorrow.
These were the textual words said to me by my 12-year-old flame in a voluptuous whisper as we happened to bump into one another on the front porch, I out, she in. The reflection of the afternoon sun, a dazzling white diamond with innumerable iridescent spikes, quivered on the round back of a parked car. The leafage of a voluminous elm played its mellow shadows upon the clapboard wall of the house. Two poplars shivered and shook. You could make out the formless sounds of remote traffic. A child calling, Nancy, Nancy! In the house, Lolita had put on her favourite Little Carmen record, which I used to call Dwarf Conductors, making her snort with mock derision at my mock wit. Thursday. Last night we sat on the piazza, the Hayes woman, Lolita, and I. Warm dusk had deepened into amorous darkness. The old girl had finished relating in great detail the plot of a movie she and Elle had seen sometime in the winter. The boxer had fallen extremely low when he met the good old priest, who had been a boxer himself in his robust youth and could still slug a sinner. We sat on cushions heaped on the floor, and Elle was between the woman and me. She had squeezed herself in, the pet. In my turn, I launched upon a hilarious account of my Arctic adventures. The muse of invention handed me a rifle, and I shot a white bear who sat down and said, Ah! All the while, I was acutely aware of Elle's nearness, and as I spoke, I gestured in the merciful dark and took advantage of those invisible gestures of mine to touch her hand, her shoulder, and a ballerina of wool and gauze which she played with and kept sticking into my lap. And finally, when I had completely enmeshed my glowing darling in this weave of ethereal caresses, I dared stroke her bare leg along the gooseberry fuzz of her shin. And I chuckled at my own jokes, and trembled, and concealed my tremors, and once or twice felt with my rapid lips the warmth of her hair as I treated her to a quick nuzzling, humorous aside, and caressed her plaything. She too fidgeted a good deal, so that finally her mother told her sharply to quit it, and sent the doll flying into the dark. And I laughed and addressed myself to Hayes across Lowe's legs to let my hand creep up my nymphette's thin back and feel her skin through her boy's shirt. But I knew it was all hopeless, and was sick with longing, and my clothes felt miserably tight, and I was almost glad when her mother's quiet voice announced in the dark, "And now we all think that Lo should go to bed."
"I think you stink," said Lo.
"Which means there will be no picnic tomorrow," said Hayes.
"This is a free country," said Lo.
When angry Lo, with a Bronx cheer, had gone, I stayed on from sheer inertia, while Hayes smoked her 10th cigarette of the evening and complained of Lo. She had been spiteful, if you please, at the age of 1, when she used to throw her toys out of her crib so that her poor mother should keep picking them up. The villainous infant. Now at 12 she was a regular pest, said Hayes. All she wanted from life was to be one day a strutting and prancing baton twirler, or a jitterbug. Her grades were poor, but she was better adjusted in her new school than in Piskey. Piskey was the Hayes hometown in the Middle West. The Ramsdale house was her late mother-in-law's. They had moved to Ramsdale less than 2 years ago. "Why, was she unhappy there?" "Oh," said Hayes, "poor me should know. I went through that when I was a kid. Boys twisting one's arm, banging into one with loads of books, pulling one's hair, hurting one's breasts, flipping one's skirt. Of course, moodiness is a common concomitant of growing up, but Lo exaggerates. Sullen and evasive, rude and defiant. Stuck Viola, an Italian schoolmate, in the seat with a fountain pen. Know what I would like? If you, monsieur, happened to be still here in the fall, I'd ask you to help her with her homework. You seem to know everything. Geography, mathematics, French."
"Oh, everything," answered monsieur.
"That means," said Hayes quickly, "you'll be here." I wanted to shout that I would stay on eternally if only I could hope to caress now and then my incipient pupil. But I was wary of Hayes. So I just grunted and stretched my limbs non-concomitantly, le mot juste, and presently went up to my room. The woman, however, was evidently not prepared to call it a day. I was already lying upon my cold bed, both hands pressing to my face Lolita's fragrant ghost, when I heard my indefatigable landlady creeping stealthily up to my door to whisper through it, just to make sure, she said, I was through with the Glance and Gulp magazine I had borrowed the other day. From her room, Lo yelled she had it. "We are quite a lending library in this house, thunder of God." Friday. I wonder what my academic publishers would say if I were to quote in my textbook Ronsard's La Vémaguette Fante, or Remy Belleau's Un petit mont feutre de mousse délicate tracé sur le milieu d'un filet d'escalade, and so forth. I shall probably have another breakdown if I stay any longer in this house under the strain of this intolerable temptation. By the side of my darling, my life, and my bride. Has she already been initiated by Mother Nature to the mystery of the menage? Bloated feeling, the curse of the Irish, falling from the roof, Grandma is visiting. Mr. Uterus, I quote from a girl's magazine, starts to build a thick, soft wall on the chance a possible baby may have to be bedded down there. The tiny madman in his padded cell. Incidentally, if I ever commit a serious murder, mark the if, the urge should be something more than the kind of thing that happened to me with Valeria. Carefully mark that then I was rather inept. If and when you wish to sizzle me to death, remember that only a spell of insanity could ever give me the simple energy to be a brute. All this amended, perhaps. Sometimes I attempt to kill in my dreams, but you know what happens. For instance, I hold a gun. For instance, I aim at a bland, quietly interested enemy. Oh, I press the trigger all right, but one bullet after another feebly drops on the floor from the sheepish muzzle. In those dreams, my only thought is to conceal the fiasco from my foe, who is slowly growing annoyed. At dinner tonight, the old cat said to me with a sidelong gleam of motherly mockery directed at Lo, I had just been describing, in a flippant vein, the delightful little toothbrush moustache I had not quite decided to grow. Better don't, if somebody is not to go absolutely dotty. Instantly, Lo pushed her plate of boiled fish away, all but knocking her milk over, and bounced out of the dining room. "Would it bore you very much," quoth Hayes, "to come with us tomorrow for a swim in our glass lake, if Lo apologizes for her manners?" Later, I heard a great banging of doors and other sounds coming from quaking caverns where the two rivals were having a ripping row. She has not apologized. The lake is out. It might have been fun.
Saturday. For some days already, I had been leaving the door ajar while I wrote in my room, but only today did the trap work. With a good deal of additional fidgeting, shuffling, and scraping to disguise her embarrassment at visiting me without having been called, Lo came in, and after pottering around, became interested in the nightmare curlicues I had penned on a sheet of paper. Oh no, they were not the outcome of a belle lettriste's inspired pause between two paragraphs. They were the hideous hieroglyphics, which she could not decipher, of my fatal lust. As she bent her brown curls over the desk at which I was sitting, Humbert the horse put his arm around her in a miserable imitation of blood relationship. And still studying, somewhat short-sightedly, the piece of paper she held, my innocent little visitor slowly sank to a half-sitting position upon my knee. Her adorable profile, parted lips, warm hair, were some 3 inches from my bared eye-tooth, and I felt the heat of her limbs through her rough tomboy clothes. All at once I knew I could kiss her throat or the wick of her mouth with perfect impunity. I knew she would let me do so, and even close her eyes as Hollywood teaches. A double vanilla with hot fudge, hardly more unusual than that. I cannot tell my learned reader, whose eyebrows I suspect have by now travelled all the way to the back of his bald head, I cannot tell him how the knowledge came to me. Perhaps my ape ear had unconsciously caught some slight change in the rhythm of her respiration, for now she was not really looking at my scribble, but waiting with curiosity and composure, oh, my limpid nymphette, for the glamorous lodger to do what he was dying to do. A modern child, an avid reader of movie magazines, an expert in dream slow close-ups, might not think it too strange, I guessed, if a handsome, intensely virile, grown-up friend... Too late. The house was suddenly vibrating with voluble Louise's voice telling Mrs. Hayes, who had just come home, about a dead something she and Leslie Thompson had found in the basement, and little Lolita was not one to miss such a tale. Sunday. Changeful, bad-tempered, cheerful, awkward, graceful, with the tart grace of her cultish sub-teens, excruciatingly desirable from head to foot, all New England for a lady writer's pen, from the black, ready-made bow and bobby pins holding her hair in place, to the little scar on the lower part of her neat calf, where a roller skater kicked her in pisky, a couple of inches above her rough white sock. Gone with her mother to the Hamiltons, a birthday party or something. Full-skirted gingham frock. Her little doves seem well-formed already. Precocious pet. Monday. Rainy morning. Ce matin gris si doux. My white pyjamas have a lilac design on the back. I am like one of those inflated, pale spiders you see in old gardens, sitting in the middle of a luminous web and giving little jerks to this or that strand. My web is spread all over the house as I listen from my chair where I sit like a wily wizard. Is Lo in her room? Gently I tug on the silk. She is not. Just heard the toilet paper cylinder make its staccato sound as it is turned, and no footfalls has my outflung filament traced from the bathroom back to her room. Is she still brushing her teeth? The only sanitary act Lo performs with real zest? No. The bathroom door has just slammed, so one has to feel elsewhere about the house for the beautiful warm-coloured prey. Let us have a strand of silk descend the stairs. I satisfy myself by this means that she is not in the kitchen, not banging the refrigerator door or screeching at her detested mamma, who, I suppose, is enjoying her third, cooing and subduedly mirthful telephone conversation of the morning. Well, let us grope and hope.
ray-like I glide in thought to the parlour, and find the radio silent, and Mama still talking to Mrs. Chatfield or Mrs. Hamilton, very softly, flushed, smiling, cupping the telephone with her free hand, denying by implication that she denies those amusing rumours, rumour, whispering intimately, as she never does the clear-cut lady in face-to-face talk. So my nymphette is not in the house at all. Gone. What I thought was a prismatic weave turns out to be but an old grey cobweb. The house is empty, is dead. And then comes Lolita's soft, sweet chuckle through my half-open door. Don't tell Mother, but I've eaten all your bacon. Gone when I scuttle out of my room. Lolita, where are you? My breakfast tray, lovingly prepared by my landlady, leers at me toothlessly, ready to be taken in. Lola. Lolita. Tuesday. Clouds again interfered with that picnic on that unattainable lake. Is it fate scheming? Yesterday I tried on before the mirror a new pair of bathing trunks. Wednesday. In the afternoon, Hayes, commonsensical shoes, tailor-made dress, said she was driving downtown to buy a present for a friend of a friend of hers, and would I please come too, because I have such a wonderful taste in textures and perfumes. Choose your favourite seduction, she purred. What could Humbert, being in the perfume business, do? She had me cornered between the front porch and her car. Hurry up, she said, as I laboriously doubled up my large body in order to crawl in, still desperately devising a means of escape. She had started the engine and was genteelly swearing at a backing and turning truck in front that had just brought old invalid Mrs. Opposite a brand new wheelchair, when my Lolita's sharp voice came from the parlour window. You! Where are you going? I'm coming too! Wait! Ignore her, yelped Hayes, killing the motor. Alas for my fair driver, Lowe's already pulling at the door on my side. This is intolerable, began Hayes, but Lowe had scrambled in, shivering with glee. Move your bottom, you, said Lowe. Lowe, cried Hayes, side-glancing at me, hoping I would throw rude Lowe out. And behold, said Lowe, not for the first time, as she jerked back, as I jerked back, as the car leapt forward. It is intolerable, said Hayes, violently getting into second. That child should be so ill-mannered, and so very persevering, when she knows she is unwanted and needs a bath. My knuckles lay against the child's blue jeans. She was barefooted. Her toenails showed remnants of cherry-red polish, and there was a bit of adhesive tape across her big toe. And God, what I would not have given to kiss then and there those delicate-boned, long-toed, monkeyish feet. Suddenly her hand slipped into mine, and without our chaperone seeing, I held and stroked and squeezed that little hot paw all the way to the store. The wings of the driver's Marlene-esque nose shone, having shed or burned up their ration of powder, and she kept up an elegant monologue anent the local traffic, and smiled in profile, and pouted in profile, and beat her painted lashes in profile, while I prayed we would never get to that store. But we did. I have nothing else to report, save primo that Big Hayes had Little Hayes sit behind on our way home, and secundo that the lady decided to keep Humbert's choice for the backs of her own shapely ears. Thursday. We are paying, with hail and gale, for the tropical beginning of the month. In a volume of the Young People's Encyclopedia, I found a map of the states that a child's pencil had started copying out on a sheet of lightweight paper, upon the other side of which, counter to the unfinished outline of Florida and the Gulf, there was a mimeographed list of names referring evidently to her class at the Ramsdale School. It is a poem I know already by heart. Angel Grace, Austin Floyd, Beale Jack, Beale Mary, Buck Daniel, Byron Marguerite, Campbell Alice, Carmine Rose, Chatfield Phyllis, Clark Gordon, Cowan John, Cowan Marion, Duncan Walter, Falter Ted, Fantasia Stella, Flashman Irving, Fox George, Glaive Mabel, Goodale Donald, Green Lucinda, Hamilton Mary Rose, Hayes, Dolores, Honeck Rosalind,
Knight, Kenneth, McCoo, Virginia, McChrystal, Vivian, McFate, Aubrey, Miranda, Anthony, Miranda, Viola, Rosato, Emil, Schlenker, Lena, Scott, Donald, Sheridan, Agnes, Sherva, Oleg, Smith, Hazel, Talbot, Edgar, Talbot, Edwin, Wayne, Lull, Williams, Ralph, Windmuller, Louise. A poem. A poem, forsooth. So strange and sweet was it to discover this Hayes Dolores, she, in its special bower of names, with its bodyguard of roses, a fairy princess between her two maids of honour. I'm trying to analyse the spine-thriller delight it gives me, this name among all those others. What is it that excites me almost to tears, hot, opalescent, thick tears that poets and lovers shed? What is it? The tender anonymity of this name with its formal veil, Dolores, and that abstract transposition of first name and surname, which is like a pair of new pale gloves or a mask. Is mask the key word? Is it because there is always delight in the semi-translucent mystery, the flowing sharshaf, through which the flesh and the eye, you alone are elected to know, smile in passing, at you alone? Or is it because I can imagine so well the rest of the colourful classroom around my dolorous and hazy darling? Grace and her ripe pimples, Ginny and her lagging leg, Gordon the haggard masturbator, Duncan the foul-smelling clown, nail-biting Agnes, Viola of the blackheads and the bouncing bust, pretty Rosaline, dark Mary Rose, adorable Stella, who has let strangers touch her. Ralph, who bullies and steals. Irving, for whom I am sorry. And there she is, there, lost in the middle, gnawing a pencil, detested by teachers, all the boys' eyes on her hair and neck. My Lolita. Friday. I long for some terrific disaster, earthquake, spectacular explosion. Her mother is messily but instantly and permanently eliminated along with everybody else for miles around. Lolita whimpers in my arms. A free man, I enjoy her among the ruins. Her surprise, my explanations, demonstrations, ululations. Idle and idiotic fancies. A brave Humbert would have played with her most disgustingly. Yesterday, for instance, when she was again in my room to show me her drawings, school artware. He might have bribed her and got away with it. A simpler and more practical fellow would have soberly stuck to various commercial substitutes, if you know where to go. I don't. Despite my manly looks, I'm horribly timid. My romantic soul gets all clammy and shivery at the thought of running into some awful, indecent unpleasantness. Those ribald sea monsters. Mais allez, allez! Annabelle, skipping on one foot to get into her shorts. I, seasick with rage, trying to screen her. Same date later. Quite late. I have turned on the light to take down a dream. It had an evident antecedent. Hayes at dinner had benevolently proclaimed that since the Weather Bureau promised a sunny weekend, we would go to the lake Sunday after church. As I lay in bed, erotically musing before trying to go to sleep, I thought of a final scheme how to profit by the picnic to come. I was aware that Mother Hayes hated my darling for her being sweet on me. So I planned my lake day with a view to satisfying the mother. To her alone would I talk. But at some appropriate moment, I would say I had left my wristwatch or my sunglasses in that glade yonder, and plunge with my nymphette into the wood. Reality at this juncture withdrew, and the quest for the glasses turned into a quiet little orgy with a singularly knowing, cheerful, corrupt, and compliant Lolita behaving as reason knew she could not possibly behave. At 3 a.m., I swallowed a sleeping pill, and presently a dream that was not a sequel but a parody revealed to me with a kind of meaningful clarity the lake I had never yet visited. It was glazed over with a sheet of emerald ice, and a pockmarked Eskimo was trying in vain to break it with a pickaxe, although imported mimosas and oleanders flowered on its gravelly banks. I'm sure Dr. Blanche Swartzman would have paid me a sack of shillings for adding such a Libby dream to her files.
Unfortunately, the rest of it was frankly eclectic. Big Hayes and Little Hayes rode on horseback around the lake, and I rode too, dutifully bobbing up and down, bow legs astraddle, although there was no horse between them, only elastic air. One of those little omissions due to the absent-mindedness of the dream agent.
Saturday. My heart is still thumping. I still squirm and emit low moans of remembered embarrassment. Dorsal view. Glimpse of shiny skin between T-shirt and white gym shorts. Bending. Over a windowsill. In the act of tearing off leaves from a poplar outside, while engrossed in torrential talk with a newspaper boy below. Kenneth Knight, I suspect, who had just propelled the Ramsdale Journal with a very precise thud onto the porch. I began creeping up to her, crippling up to her, as pantomimists say. My arms and legs were convex surfaces between which, rather than upon which, I slowly progressed by some neutral means of locomotion. Humbert the wounded spider. I must have taken hours to reach her. I seemed to see her through the wrong end of a telescope, and toward her taut little rear I moved like some paralytic on soft, distorted limbs in terrible concentration. At last I was right behind her when I had the unfortunate idea of blustering a trifle, shaking her by the scruff of the neck and that sort of thing to cover my real manège. And she said in a shrill, brief whine, "Cut it out!" Most coarsely, the little wench, and with a ghastly grin, Humbert the Humble beat a gloomy retreat while she went on wisecracking streetward. But now listen to what happened next. After lunch, I was reclining in a low chair trying to read. Suddenly, two deft little hands were over my eyes. She had crept up from behind as if reenacting, in a ballet sequence, my morning manoeuvre. Her fingers were a luminous crimson as they tried to blot out the sun, and she uttered hiccups of laughter and jerked this way and that as I stretched my arms sideways and backwards without otherwise changing my recumbent position. My hand swept over her agile, giggling legs, and the book, like a sleigh, left my lap, and Mrs. Hayes strolled up and said indulgently, "Just slap her hard if she interferes with your scholarly meditations. How I love this garden!" No exclamation mark in her tone. "Isn't it divine in the sun?" No question mark either. And with a sign of feigned content, the obnoxious lady sank down on the grass and looked up at the sky as she leaned back on her splayed-out hands. And presently an old grey tennis ball bounced over her, and Lowe's voice came from the house haughtily, "Pardon, eh, mother, I was not aiming at you." "Of course not, my hot, downy darling." This proved to be the last of 20 entries or so. It will be seen from them that for all the devil's inventiveness, the scheme remained daily the same. First he would tempt me, and then thwart me, leaving me with a dull pain in the very root of my being. I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and how to do it, without impinging on a child's chastity. After all, I had had some experience in my life of pederosis. Had visually possessed dappled nymphets in parks, had wedged my wary and bestial way into the hottest, most crowded corner of a city bus full of strap-hanging schoolchildren. But for almost 3 weeks I had been interrupted in all my pathetic machinations. The agent of these interruptions was usually the Hayes woman, who, as the reader will mark, was more afraid of Lowe's deriving some pleasure from me than of my enjoying Lowe. The passion I had developed for that nymphette, for the first nymphette in my life that could be reached at last by my awkward, aching, timid claws, would have certainly landed me again in a sanatorium, had not the devil realized that I was to be granted some relief if he wanted to have me as a plaything for some time longer. The reader has also marked the curious mirage of the lake. It would have been logical on the part of Aubrey McFate, as I would like to dub that devil of mine, to arrange a small treat for me on the promised beach in the presumed forest. Actually, the promise Mrs. Hayes had made was a fraudulent one. She had not told me that Mary Rose Hamilton, a dark little beauty in her own right, was to come too, and that the two nymphettes would be whispering apart, and playing apart, and having a good time
all by themselves, while Mrs. Hayes and her handsome lodger conversed sedately in the semi-nude, far from prying eyes. Incidentally, eyes did pry and tongues did wag. How queer life is! We hasten to alienate the very fates we intended to woo. Before my actual arrival, my landlady had planned to have an old spinster, a Miss Phelan, whose mother had been cook in Mrs. Hayes's family, come to stay in the house with Lolita and me while Mrs. Hayes, a career girl at heart, sought some suitable job in the nearest city. Mrs. Hayes had seen the whole situation very clearly. The bespectacled, round-backed Herr Humbert, coming with his Central European trunks to gather dust in his corner behind a heap of old books. The unloved, ugly little daughter, firmly supervised by Miss Phelan, who had already once had my Lo under her buzzard wing. Lo recalled that 1944 summer with an indignant shudder, and Mrs. Hayes herself engaged as a receptionist in a great, elegant city. But a not-too-complicated event interfered with that programme. Miss Phelan broke her hip in Savannah, Georgia, on the very day I arrived in Ramsdale. The Sunday after the Saturday already described proved to be as bright as the weatherman had predicted. When putting the breakfast things back on the chair outside my room for my good landlady to remove at her convenience, I gleaned the following situation by listening from the landing across which I had softly crept to the banisters in my old bedroom slippers, the only old things about me. There had been another row. Mrs. Hamilton had telephoned that her daughter was running a temperature. Mrs. Hayes informed her daughter that the picnic would have to be postponed. Hot little Hayes informed big cold Hayes that if so, she would not go with her to church. Mother said very well and left. I had come out on the landing straight after shaving, soapy ear-lobed, still in my white pyjamas with the cornflower blue, not the lilac, design on the back. I now wiped off the soap, perfumed my hair and armpits, slipped on a purple silk dressing gown, and humming nervously, went down the stairs in quest of Lo. I want my learned readers to participate in the scene I am about to replay. I want them to examine its every detail, and see for themselves how careful, how chaste, the whole wine-sweet event is, if viewed with what my lawyer has called, in the private talk we've had, impartial sympathy. So, let us get started. I have a difficult job before me. Main character, Humbert the Hummer. Time, Sunday morning in June. Place, sunlit living room. Props, old candy-striped Davenport, magazines, phonograph, Mexican knick-knacks. The late Mr. Harold E. Hayes, God bless the good man, had engendered my darling at the siesta hour in a blue-washed room on a honeymoon trip to Veracruz. And mementos among these, Dolores, were all over the place. She wore that day a pretty print dress that I had seen on her once before, ample in the skirt, tight in the bodice, short-sleeved, pink, checkered with darker pink, and to complete the colour scheme she had painted her lips, and was holding in her hollowed hands a beautiful, banal, Eden-red apple. She was not shod, however, for church, and her white Sunday purse lay discarded near the phonograph. My heart beat like a drum as she sat down, cool skirt ballooning, subsiding on the sofa next to me, and played with her glossy fruit. She tossed it up into the sun-dusted air and caught it. It made a cupped, polished plop. Humbert intercepted the apple. "Give it back," she pleaded, showing the marbled flush of her palms. I produced delicious. She grasped it and bit into it, and my heart was like snow under thin crimson skin, and with the monkeyish nimbleness that was so typical of that American nymphette, she snatched out of my abstract grip the magazine I had opened. Pity no film had recorded the curious pattern, the monogramic linkage of our simultaneous or overlapping moves. Rapidly, hardly hampered by the disfigured apple she held, Lo flipped violently through the pages in search of something she wished Humbert to see. Found it at last. I faked interest by bringing my head so close that her hair touched my temple and her arm brushed my cheek as she wiped her lips with her wrist. Because of the burnished mist through which I peered at the picture, I was slow in reacting to it, and her bare knees rubbed and knocked impatiently against each other. Dimly there came into view a surrealist painter relaxing supine on a beach, and near him, likewise supine, a plaster replica of the Venus de Milo, half buried in sand. "Picture of the week," said the legend. I whisked the whole obscene thing away. Next moment, in a sham effort to retrieve it, she was all over me. Caught her by her thin, knobby wrist. The magazine escaped to the floor like a flustered fowl. She twisted herself free, recoiled, and lay back in the right-hand corner of the davenport. Then, with perfect simplicity, the impudent child extended her legs across my lap. By this time I was in a state of excitement bordering on insanity. But I also had the cunning of the insane. Sitting there on the sofa, I managed to attune by a series of stealthy movements my masked lust to her guileless limbs. It was no easy matter to divert the little maiden's attention while I performed the obscure adjustments necessary for the success of the trick. Talking fast, lagging behind my own breath, catching up with it, mimicking a sudden toothache to explain the breaks in my patter, and all the while keeping a maniac's inner eye on my distant golden goal, I cautiously increased the magic friction that was doing away, in an illusional, if not factual sense, with the physically irremovable, but psychologically very friable texture of the material divide, pajamas and robe, between the weight of two sunburnt legs resting athwart my lap and the hidden tumour of an unspeakable passion. Having, in the course of my patter, hit upon something nicely mechanical, I recited, garbling them slightly, the words of a foolish song that was then popular. "Oh, my Carmen, my little Carmen, something, something, those something nights, and the stars, and the cars, and the bars, and the barmen." I kept repeating this automatic stuff and holding her under its special spell because of the garbling, and all the while I was mortally afraid that some act of God might interrupt me, might remove the golden load in the sensation of which all my being seemed concentrated, and this anxiety forced me to work, for the first minute or so, more hastily than was consensual with deliberately modulated enjoyment. The stars that sparkled and the cars that parkled and the bars and the barmen were presently taken over by her. Her voice stole and corrected the tune I had been mutilating. She was musical and apple-sweet. Her legs twitched a little as they lay across my live lap. I stroked them. There she lolled in the right-hand corner, almost a sprawl, Lola the Bobbysoxer, devouring her immemorial fruit. Singing through its juice, losing her slipper, rubbing the heel of her slipperless foot in its sloppy anklet against the pile of old magazines heaped on my left on the sofa, and every movement she made, every shuffle and ripple, helped me to conceal and to improve the secret system of tactile correspondence between beast and beauty, between my gagged, bursting beast and the beauty of her dimpled body in its innocent cotton frock. Under my glancing fingertips I felt the minute hairs bristle ever so slightly along her shins. I lost myself in the pungent but healthy heat which like summer haze hung about little haze. "Let us stay, let us stay." As she strained to chuck the core of her abolished apple into the fender, her young weight, her shameless innocent shanks and round bottom, shifted in my tense, tortured, surreptitiously labouring lap. And all of a sudden a mysterious change came over my senses. I entered a plane of being where nothing mattered save the infusion of joy brewed within my body. What had begun as a delicious distension of my innermost roots became a glowing tingle which now had reached that state of absolute security, confidence, and reliance not found elsewhere in conscious life. With the deep, hot sweetness thus established and well on its way to the ultimate convulsion, I felt I could slow down in order to prolong the glow. Lolita had been safely solipsized. The implied sun pulsated in the supplied poplars. We were fantastically and divinely alone. I watched her, rosy, gold-dusted beyond the veil of my controlled delight. Unaware of it, alien to it, and the sun was on her lips, and her lips were apparently still forming the words of the Carmen Barmen ditty that no longer reached my consciousness. Everything was now ready. The nerves of pleasure had been laid bare. The corpuscles of Krauss were entering the phase of frenzy. The least pressure would suffice to set all paradise loose. I had ceased to be Humbert the hound, the sad-eyed degenerate cur clasping the boot that would presently kick him away. I was above the tribulations of ridicule, beyond the possibilities of retribution. In my self-made seraglio, I was a radiant and robust Turk, deliberately, in the full consciousness of his freedom, postponing the moment of actually enjoying the youngest and frailest of his slaves. Suspended on the brink of that voluptuous abyss, a nicety of physiological equipoise comparable to certain techniques in the arts, I kept repeating chance words after her. Barmen, alarmin, my charmin, my carmin, armin, ah, ah, amen, as one talking and laughing in his sleep, while my happy hand crept up her sunny leg as far as the shadow of decency allowed. The day before she had collided with the heavy chest in the hall, and, "Look, look," I gasped, "look what you've done, what have you done to yourself, oh, look!" For there was, I swear, a yellowish-violet bruise on her lovely nymphet thigh, which my huge hairy hand massaged and slowly enveloped. And because of her very perfunctory underthings, there seemed to be nothing to prevent my muscular thumb from reaching the hot hollow of her groin, just as you might tickle and caress a giggling child. Just that, and, "Oh, it's nothing at all," she cried, with a sudden shrill note in her voice. And she wiggled and squirmed and threw her head back, and her teeth rested on her glistening underlip as she half turned away, and my moaning mouth, gentlemen of the jury, almost reached her bare neck, while I crushed out against her left buttock the last throb of the longest ecstasy man or monster had ever known. Immediately afterward, as if she had been struggling and now my grip had eased, she rolled off the sofa and jumped to her feet, to her foot, rather, in order to attend to the formidably loud telephone that may have been ringing for ages as far as I was concerned. There she stood and blinked, cheeks aflame, hair awry, her eyes passing over me as lightly as they did over the furniture. And as she listened or spoke to her mother, who was telling her to come to lunch with her at the Chatsfields, neither Low nor Hum knew yet what busybody Hayes was plotting. She kept tapping the edge of the table with the slipper she held in her hand. Blessed be the Lord, she had noticed nothing. With a handkerchief of multicoloured silk on which her listening eyes rested in passing, I wiped the sweat off my forehead, and immersed in a euphoria of release, rearranged my royal robes. She was still at the telephone, haggling with her mother. Wanted to be fetched by car, my little Carmen. When, singing louder and louder, I swept up the stairs and set a deluge of steaming water roaring into the tub. At this point I may as well give the words of that song hit in full, to the best of my recollection at least. I don't think I ever had it right. Here goes. "Oh, my Carmen, my little Carmen, something, something, there's something, nights, and the stars, and the cars, and the bars, and the barmen, and, oh, my Charmin, our dreadful fights, and the something town where so gaily arm in arm we went, and our final row, and the gun I killed you with, oh my Carmen, the gun I'm holding now." Drew his .32 automatic, I guess, and put a bullet through his mole's eye.